Hello, my name is Zachar Karetsky, and this is the Transitions Visions podcast, a podcast series about and for the sustainability transitions community. Today we will discuss transitions to a prior state of a system with the concept of detransitions, coined by researchers from Maastricht Sustainability Institute, Chloe Talian-Deer and Mark Dyke. This is an intriguing idea that gives a spin to transitions and implies a phenomenon that on the surface looks like copying the past. To find out if it's actually as it looks, listen to my discussion with Chloe and Mark.
In your paper a bit selfishly, because it touches on the topic that I have also studied a bit before, and it's about detransitions and mobility. So I was wondering if maybe Chloe, you could tell how the topic came about.
So when we initiated the research, we agreed that maybe it would be nice to have a look at middle-sized city. Because larger cities have been studied quite often. And then I came from a middle-sized city, so that was a bit of a coincidence, or maybe not, I don't know. When we started doing the research, we very rapidly found out that there had been a different mobility system in place, and that this mobility system was removed at some point in time in the 1970s. To be finally reinstalled quite a few years later when the municipality realized that there was a problem with mobility and a lot of congestion in the city. And that's when the tramway came back.
Yeah, and which city do you mean?
Clermont-Ferrand.
Yeah.
So that's in France.
Yeah.
Central France.
Yeah. So it was really an empirically driven topic.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so we started with the empirics, yeah, indeed, yeah.
So then, immediately, what's the difference between transition and detransition? Because this, you mentioned it in the title of the paper, detransition.
Yeah. No, so indeed, the concept came later than the study, you could say, or a bit at the end of it. We have been interested in sort of past transitions in the last few years more. So then we studied the past transition in Clermont-Ferrand, and we found out that they were actually, well, as Chloe said, reinstalling something which had been there in the times where it was more sustainable, it seems, than now. So then we thought, yeah, actually they are not only making a transition, but that they are actually seem to be making attempts to return to a state that the earlier had with a big tram network. So I think that, sort of reflecting on that, we came up with the idea, in fact, it is a sort of detransition. Also because we had been studying sort of transition to car mobility in another historic study, so from a cycling city to a car-based city. We had called that a transition, and now we were adding a component. Like an earlier study in Maastricht basically is still in the mainly car-based state. Well, in Clermont-Ferrand is not much better, but at least there is a clear sign of a network, tram network, that is similar to what it was before. So then we thought, well, actually, this is not just a transition, but you can see it as a process that sort of is an attempt to be reversed. That's how we came up with the idea of detransition.
Mm-hmm. So the reverse. So detransition would be a reverse of transition.
Yeah, I would say so. It is a transition, a process that goes from state A to state B, and then an ambition and the start of a process that is trying to go back to state A, at least to some extent. Of course, social systems, they do not totally reverse and do not, and then the situation will never be totally similar as the 1950s, but in some key elements, some key characteristics, in this case, having a few cars, a relatively low share of cars, it is a sort of a return to it. And then, well, then sort of balancing that on the one hand, there is some reverse steps that you could learn from how you got there and how to get back. On the other hand, it's obvious that it is also a new process, and it's never going to be exactly the same as it was.
Mm-hmm. And I think it works well in your case, trams, return to trams, and it's very visible, very material. Does it also work universally in other cases? Have you started exploring that?
Maybe it is the case of cycling in the Netherlands, which in the 1970s they kind of came back to, especially I think it was in the municipality of Utrecht, that they starting reducing the number of cars and reinstalling cycling lanes, or at least encouraging cycling again, which was there before the big car transition. So it seems like this is something that could be compared to, although the percentage of people cycling in the Netherlands is probably bigger than the percentage of people taking the tramway in Clermont-Ferrand, so that may...
Yeah. No, so I agree indeed. I think it's sort of the transition to a car, and not carless, but low-car cities. I think it could be used in that regard also with other modalities. Also involved in a more circular economy type of projects, we also played with the concept of, for instance, detransition to a sort of plasticless way of living, or packageless. That in the 1950s we didn't have all these packages around everything. It was much more using your own cups and jars. And in that respect, we also, you can on the one hand show the transition towards a sort of consumption society and a high packaging society, but you could also study what it means to go back and learn from also these past practices. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not totally different than of course the transition concept as such, but it sort of adds something on it and it says, well, if you, of course, there are many projects that are looking to experiments towards sustainable some sector, but I think this is a proposal to extend your study in time, go further back in the past, because for many cases, for many problems, actually the way towards that problem can help to think about the way out of the problem. So I think to use the knowledge of the transition towards unsustainability, that's also the sort of the language we used in the Maastricht study a few years earlier. It's basically a transition towards unsustainability, and that is that's what you can learn to how to get away from this many unsustainable systems.
And you just mentioned, Mark, about practices, and I think you're using practice theory in your work, in your paper, in this one. And I wonder how does this work with when you're talking about cities and infrastructure, and then you also apply practice theory.
We were quite happy with it, the way it provides insights. So, I think compared to more mainstream transition studies, I think... Well, there are a few things to say about it, but one of the main differences may be that there is more attention for meanings, and that sort of gives, I think it opens up a bit the local perspective of particular travelers or urban planners. Of course, I think there's still a way to go with practice approaches in transitions. I think that's and that's normal in academic fields. There's ways to improve it. For instance, how to find out exactly whether you would like to see infrastructures as part of the practice or practices taking place in the context of infrastructures. The same with policy, by the way. Are policy structures, policy incentives, actually, should they be an element in the practices or are they externally affecting practices? Mm-hmm. I think that is part of the conceptual development that we're well, we should be doing, and at least I'm trying to contribute to that, because well, we're also sort of still broadening the type of practices that we study in one study, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I think many studies initially focused a bit more on the consumption side, so maybe the way, for instance, the three elements that are very useful, I think, the three-element model of Schaub et al. But maybe because when you start including business practices, planning or regulatory practices, maybe there are more than three elements needed to have a sort of an effective framework. So I think that's something to find out in the study of us. Chloe used also the fourth type of element, policy. Mm-hmm. I think that was helpful to actually understand how the practices evolved. And
That was the rationale, Chloe?
Yes.
Indeed. I can unpack it a bit. So what did you add?
It became very clear from the onset of the research that policy had a very significant impact in the modes that were used in the city, because it's not that the tramway was removed because people were not content with it anymore, but more that there was this will from the municipality to have something new, to move towards modernity, and the tramway was really seen as something from the past, and that's when they decided basically to decommission the tramway, so really to remove the tramway from the city, and that's led to more space to cars, and the cars could also more freely move around the city compared to the tramway that was limited to the rails, obviously. So it was really policy driven, and that was very clear from the onset. And the reincorporation of the tramway within the city was also led by the municipality. So again, by policy makers, urban policy makers. So, we found out that it was really crucial to have that element as well as the other three. And also, if you look more at the national level, there were also some incentives to use certain means of mobility, especially in the more recent years, with, for instance, incentives to buy an electric bike or to buy an electric car.
So you have now policies, these four elements, meanings, materials, and competences, and they all are part of the same kind of system or network or configuration. And how do you deal with more exogenous factors? How did you deal with that in your paper? Like policy pressure or maybe competition?
The sort of the practices are the key unit of analysis, and basically the city becomes a patchwork of social practices, you could say. So we have also in the Maastricht study, the earlier one sort of struggled a bit, indeed, like how do you deal with like support groups, for instance, which do play a role, but which are not, which are a factor, but not so much a practice that you may want to highlight. I think for me that the practices concept is helpful in the sense that it is a sort of you could say it goes beyond the agency structure, but you could also say it takes them in a balanced way, in the sense that there is also agency. So in that sense you could also deal with issues of power in that respect. I think that's also something that still needs to be elaborated and found out, and we're also starting projects who look at that. But I think it is possible to show why particular practices are done or are being changed, because there are other actors who influence you in some way or another. It comes in a slightly different way, but I think it is possible.
Right. So in social practice, indeed, as you just said, there's a it tries to balance agency and structure. And I'm thinking immediately of ideologies and sort of knowledge paradigms in your case as well. Did that, how did you deal with that in really on an empirical or an analytical basis, actually?
Once again, could you...
In the corporation, did you incorporate any of these structural... In what way, actually?
How we dealt with structural elements. So again, the practices themselves, they become sort of the main thing you look at. So if you speak about a municipality, then indeed you conceptualize that as a planning procedure or a planning process, a planning practice, and not so much as the various. The structure of the municipality as such. But again, through the practices, these things can come in the sense that if different departments, if the municipality can't be seen as one planning procedure, planning practice anymore, then you would start to distinguish different planning practices related to different parts of the municipality or different departments, for instance. But you wouldn't, you wouldn't start sort of describing the structure of the government in that respect. Yeah, so it is a particular angle that you take, and obviously for some questions and some problems that can be fruitful. But obviously, for other problems, a purely more structural perspective will be more instrumental.
So the focus is really on practices. How they engage with each other, how they disband.
How they influence each other in terms of how they co-evolve. Mm-hmm. That's also a concept that we're using, so co-evolving practices. And
okay. In the paper, you have very interesting illustrations. And then, was that? It looks a lot like system dynamics, or at least some kind of portrayal of a system. Did you actually engage with system dynamics, or was it more of an for illustration purposes? That you connected all these different parts or components of the social practice.
I think the idea was really to show the interconnectedness of all the practices that were happening around mobility, so all these modes, how they interact with each other, how they share some common elements, such as infrastructure maybe. And it does look like a system on its own, but I'm not sure that we used a system analysis
language.
Okay.
Yeah. No, so I think indeed everything is a system in that sense. Eh? So you could use the label system here as well, but you could just as well not, I guess. So we're not using system dynamics in the sense of... system dynamics modeling in terms of sort of quantitative effects of the elements. That's not at all the direction we are going. So they are qualitative relationships. We did sort of indicate whether relationships are sort of whether elements are well aligned. We made them green in the analysis, or whether they are problematic, and then they were red. Could also be sort of neutral or gray. So it looks like, well, I mean, it's also a systematic analysis, and therefore it does give the impression of a system, and in some way you could call it that way. But in this case, there's not. We didn't think about sort of going a step towards sort of quantification of the relationships. There was somebody at IST also asked about it, who was a modeler, and was wondering whether this is also a step towards another modeling approach of transitions. Mm-hmm. Well, that's something to think about maybe. We didn't do that, Of course, the social practices studies, at least up to now, are very qualitative and descriptive, and so relationship between elements are all multidimensional, and so it would be a relative big sort of simplifying step to sort of translate that into, you could play with the idea of having a good alignment of elements plus plus or plus zero minus minus mm-hmm. minus, but
so a more qualitative kind of model.
Sort of semi-qualitative, semi-quantitative. You could, you would have to look maybe for some problems that is that can be helpful.
Well, not everything has to be quantified.
No, exactly.
Can be. So it's also interesting for PhD students who are listening and looking at how this can be done.
Yeah.
They don't have to be a modeler. So coming back to the detransition concept, is it something, concept such as retention and selection and variation something that you are also working with when working with detransitions? Now or in the future?
Yeah, so we haven't done that now. We have not been using those terms. So we speak about co-evolving practices. Mm-hmm. You could use the terms like you could say that when the tram was reinstalled, it was sort of increasing variety of mobility options, mm-hmm. and when it was broken down, that it was a sort of selecting other options and leaving these out and reducing variety. Mm-hmm. I think I'm not sure there's the it adds a lot when those notions are picked up here. They're often used in a more sort of positivistic sense, maybe sort of distant view of patterns of what happens, whereas here you really sort of from the inside sort of follow how practices, whether new elements are emerging, whether some elements disappear. Mm-hmm. So in some way it is about variety and selection, but in a different angle. So the using those terms as such and the perspective of variation, selection, and retention, I'm not sure it adds much in this case.
I'm asking this because I also worked in my PhD with social practice, and then I got asked this similar question.
Okay, at your defense.
Yes.
Yes. And what did you say?
Not in my defense.
Okay.
But the feedback to the PhD.
Ah,
Not as good as you. As you came up with an answer. So, can you help walk through how exactly the practices, how does the contraction of practices happens towards a detransition, maybe briefly? So there's an established practice, and there's a detransition.
Yes. The detransition that we are mostly talking about, I think, is really in the more recent days when we say that there's the introduction of new, more sustainable practices, or the reemergence of more sustainable practices with the tramway and cycling that is coming back, the contraction of the practice of driving the car is not sudden, it's not happening in one day, so it's something that you see gradually happening. And because we conducted interviews about what were the practices in the early 2000s, so just before the tramway was reintroduced, but also later on, what people have been doing now, you see that there's quite a difference in terms of the narrative people are using when it comes to the meaning of using the car. For instance, in the early 2000s, it was very normal to drive the car, everybody would do it, whereas now people start questioning it. There's also this layer of a bit environmental concern linked to the using the card is some kind of shame that starts to emerge from that extensive use of the car. So it's not to say that car mobility has disappeared, but we do see a shift in terms of the meaning associated with it that could point towards the transition in the coming years. And also because you increase the variety of modes available with the tramway that was introduced, but also with some policies that are pulling people to using a bit more the bicycle, with bicycle stations that were installed in the city and some cycling lanes that were materialized in the city, you also basically offer the people a new way of moving around, or you renew that option in any case. So the contraction is not happening right now. The shift hasn't happened completely, but you do see that there's a shift in terms of how people talk about moving around with the car, and also more positive talk about how people move around with the tram or with the bicycle as well, which was quite interesting, that there was quite a renewed energy for using the bicycle, which was kind of lost in the early 2000s, where nobody mentioned that it would be cycling. And when you would ask them, why weren't you cycling? What did you think about it at this time? And people were like, I wouldn't have never done it. It was just too dangerous and people weren't aware that there could be people cycling around, so there was really no culture around cycling at this stage, which was reinstalled a bit later with the shift in paradigm.
Now it made me think about the transition as a really sort of, there was a transition and now there's a process of detransitioning happening, and it seems to imply like a strong trajectory or pathway. And maybe did anyone during peer review, did you encounter this, maybe a critique about technological determinism that you possibly are enforcing with this focus on trajectory?
Mm-hmm. No, that was not so much flagged.
What would you respond to such a question?
Yeah, so... Well, it is true, but many, I think, sustainability studies, they are normative in the sense that they suggest a particular direction, and at the same time you could say, well, it's not one pathway in most cases, but in this case, indeed, there is a sort of, you do advocate for constraining car mobility, and... Well, obviously, also in this case, that people do not are not in consensus about it. Of course, there's also a trajectory where people say, well, if we make everything zero emission, if we make all cars zero emission, actually that is that's also a sustainable mobility system. So I think these battles are still there, and in terms of, well, there's not one pathway, I think, in the sense one way to go, but there is sort of, when you go to a low-car city, there is a particular sort of indicator, the number of cars that you say that needs to decrease. But the way to get there, I think there are still... different ways in that sense. So it's it is not too prescriptive, but it is the end point is clear, and there's a challenge. I mean, I think this detraction process, it's a challenge of but then you end up with, I think, similar things that other transition studies have suggested, like it's both building up the alternative, in this case non-car options. It is constraining the practice that you'd like to see contracting, and it's also looking at the relationship with neighboring practices around it. So the question of where people work and where they live, how they shop, whether there are big shopping malls or whether there are small shops in the city center. Mm-hmm. So there's, so it is remains a complicated process, but maybe, again, beyond or adding to what transition studies have already been saying, I think it puts more light on the historic situation that also that already existed on that particular place and which did function, and where you can with hindsight also see the positive aspects from. If you see the pictures in this case of Clermont-Ferrand in the 1950s, much less busy on the street, or busy with bicycles more, or at tram stations, which I think to most people looks more attractive than the streets full of cars.
Mm-hmm. But it's still, I don't think you mean to imply that the past was always better.
No, not in general. No. So you can't say that every problem that the transition is the answer. Yeah. But for some cases, as I said, I think the same with packaging. I think that you can sort of, that you don't have to reinvent the wheel always, but that there is quite something to learn from how things worked in the past before there was such a big use of all sorts of materials and.
So you're really in this kind of contributing to the arguments around the growth as well, in a sense, as a lot of sustainability transitions. Yeah. I guess.
Yeah. No, I think for many cases that that can be in a fruitful way of thinking, but it's only a concept. Eh? It's not the holy grail of everything. Yeah.
But I did wonder about push and pull measures, because you are. As a core part of your analysis, right? And that's part of the reason why you included policies as a fourth dimension to the practice. Could you say a bit more about what's the role of push and pull measures are in the analytical framework?
We include that element about policy incentives in the framework, and we do understand this as a mix of policies, so it's not just a policy that will encourage people to cycle, to pull people towards cycling, but also it needs to be a mix of policy that is also creating an environment that is welcoming for cycling. So it's not because you incentivize people to cycle that it will be cycling, especially because in our study it was really shown that there was a big insecurity in cycling because the roads had become too dangerous. Mm-hmm. So you also need to combine this pull policy with a push policy. So push people away from using the car, diminish that that share of car mobility in the city. Mm-hmm. So as to make it a bit easier to navigate around also with the bike, and to make it a bit less dangerous. So the mix of policy needs to be combining the two types of push and pull. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if you only have the pull, you may promise a carrot, but it's not always sure that the rabbit will come. So yes, you really need to have this combination. Mm-hmm.
Am I correct that you are using reconfiguration in your paper?
Yeah.
How does it relate with the rest of the analytical framework?
Yeah, I think it's a nice term or concept to use when speaking about changing practices. I mean, of course, reconfiguration in some ways is an alternative term as change, but I think it is a bit more specific in the sense that it assumes a particular configuration being there, which is the existing practice with all sorts of elements that the practice consists of. And then there is a reconfiguration, so a change in the way that these practices are shaped. And so I think it's a nice concept to speak about new elements emerging, some elements disappearing. So in that that way we've also used it in the paper. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speaking about element disappearing, when do you, a bit of a methodological, also epistemological question, how do you actually know when an element has disappeared?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I think in our study, and the method that we use, which is a combination of interviews and document analysis, so maybe the question before that is, when do you call something an element? And that is, well, of course, it's not a speed device that you can sort of clearly measure something, but it is a qualitative interpretation of when multiple people speak about cycling becoming dangerous after it became busier on the road. And then, that was the way we started. Then, in a new decade, start to say, well, actually cycling, the meaning of cycling becomes associated with being dangerous, and so that is also usually when, or at least in our case, when they stopped using the term normal. Whereas initially, before the car was there, they say, well, everybody did it, so, and almost nobody had a car, so you used the bicycle to go to the other side of town, and that was normal. And then at some point they say, it became a bit busier on the road, it was a bit dangerous, and then a number of your interviewees mentioned that, and that is the way you say, well, actually, the normalness had disappeared by now, and dangerous is a new meaning in this in these years. Well, that is the way we dealt with it.
So a really detailed sort of discourse analysis, linguistic analysis.
Yeah, well, an analysis of the transcriptions, indeed. Mm-hmm. And there's always the question of how many interviews you need. Mm-hmm. And we used sort of the criterion of. Saturation criterion, that if you start hearing the same stories, then you stop. But of course, there is a level of detail. There is a choice that, in the course or in our teaching, we also use it. And then sometimes students say, well, you sort of assume that cycling in the city is everywhere the same. And whereas maybe for different parts of the city, it was actually different. Well, and that's true. I mean, there's always a more detailed level, a closer examination that you could do. So I think the way we did it, you can already sort of show how cycling in this city was perceived, mm-hmm. as opposed to studies where it is assumed that in the whole country, and there are many nation-based transition studies sort of assuming that the modality is the same in the whole country. Whereas I think we focused on a city and you show how it is being seen there. But that is also, only one step. You could also say, well, actually within the cyclist community there are different sub-meanings and subgroups in cycling. But that would require an even, well, first of all, more empirical work, and also in the case that you want to sort of speak about a model shift in the city, it's the question of whether that is sort of needed or to make that analysis. Unless you would sort of like to do recommendations in a particular neighborhood, for instance, or
No, that's insightful. It's very interesting, and I appreciated how you managed to kind of do a social archaeology, but really find people who have been living in those times when you were trans. So.
Yeah. Now that was quite funny. We also sort of knew, both in the Maastricht and in the Clermont-Ferrand case, we did that. But people have much more time than other people. So they are happy to speak about the past. And it's a new way of studying past transitions. Of course, you have to make sure that people are not sort of making particular characteristic of their caricature, I mean, of the past, or do some sort of past rationalization. But,
I was So I was when I was reading this paper, I was wondering if you are also willing, if you are problematizing the reemergence of elements. So, for example, some of them were. You could say that some elements were revived, while some others were from clean slate designed or developed or appeared. Do you engage with this difference, or what do you think about it?
It's not something we directly engage with in the paper. Okay. We do not really have a difference for the elements that were revived through a combination of circumstances and culture that is motivating this element to be revived, or whether it was whether it was put in place by the municipality as a new thing. Mm-hmm. So it's not something we really have a look at. So maybe it could be interesting for the studies to really differentiate things reappearing from the past compared to things that are installed, maybe technology driven as well.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting further elaboration of the transition, indeed, looking to the things that re-emerged, see the difference between, for some people, they don't think about the past, probably, so it's just something new, whereas for others, it could be a step back, which could be something positive, but can also be something negative. Eh? People can also say, also with this story, like, we don't want to go back to the 1950s. They would associate it with loss of progress, loss of some freedom that they have, of opportunities. Whereas for others, it could have positive associations with going back to a time that things were more sustainable in some definition. So that could be something to look at. So that also shows the sort of the benefits and the disadvantages of maybe making this whole detransition concept something in a sort of policy strategy. Yeah, that's also something you can think about. Like, would this for the local government in Clermont-Ferrand, would it be actually an attractive option to sort of start bringing in this idea of we already know what can be a nice public, what public quality of public space is. Mm-hmm. We would like to return to the high quality that we had in the past, where you could where it was nicer to be outside. Or would that be actually a risk of saying people, well, actually, I don't want to go back to that those days, because now I have my car and I have much more opportunities, and everything that that takes that away should be avoided.
Do you plan to continue with this concept of detransitions in your research?
Chloe, what are your plans?
Probably, hopefully. I was very recently at some negotiations on the plastic treaty, and there were quite a few discussions about some countries that would see some substitutes of plastic being brought back, as in paper, glass, mm-hmm. like jars and stuff like that, in place of plastic wrapping and packaging. And I immediately thought back of the concept of detransition, because it's clearly what they are pointing at. So it could be something that I will be looking at in the future. It's not yet certain, but I think there's still quite a lot of work to be done on that on that concept, to better understand it and to see to what it could be applied and how.
Now, it also relates to the also to some extent it relates to the transitions to unsustainability studies that you were involved in, I think, or not, or is it
unsustainability is higher than published something on that.
So that's also because the first part then of the detransition. Well, detransition is the second step, but it follows then a transition to unsustainability usually. So it's also in that respect overlapping with that. I think we will also here do take it further, but there are other lines like the more conceptual social practices perspective in transition, I think, is also something in parallel that that we are working on.
Did you show this to Elizabeth Schoff?
No, I didn't meet her yet in person, at least not in the last years, in the past months. But no, so we are, we're not talking directly to her, but we are, I'm talking to it with other transition colleagues, with people interested in social practice approaches, and then see how it can be developed further.
Thank you very much, Mark, Chloe, for meeting me, discussing detransitions.
Thank you.
Very welcome.